Mother Tankersley. Conflict, unresolved, unmanaged, uncontrolled conflict is destroying our communities and hurting our families and really making us physically ill. Now, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You already know that. We see it every day in the headlines. We read about it all the time. And my question is that I'm on kind of the search to figure out is how can we do conflict better? Because we have to figure this out. We have to. There has to be a better way to do this. I am a divorce attorney. I handle high conflict cases. I try and keep my clients out of high conflict cases, but if one party wants a fight, then we're going to have a fight. In the 16 years that I've been doing divorce work, I've had three extremely high conflict cases. Really, the other party, of course, was the instigator of the high conflict, but the ramifications, the consequences of the high conflict divorce are just devastating on the children. In each of those three families, they had teenagers, and the teenagers made suicidal threats and ended up in a mental institution during the divorce process. And so that's not a coincidence, right? We know conflict has devastating impact on our families. Today we're going to talk about conflict, and what I want to do is explore how we as Christians can view conflict as an opportunity for transformation. It's one of the unique things that we bring into this world, and I don't think we're talking about it enough. But we have resources and a toolbox to draw upon and to offer the world something that's really valuable and important. But I also want to explore our physiological responses to conflict, because I think this is so important that we are aware of what is happening. Now, I am a lawyer. I am not a psychologist. I am not a brain scientist. Everything you're going to hear me talk about today, I've learned on the internet, or I've learned from people who are professionals and who teach classes. I've done a lot of work in this area. But I think it's really important to look at what happens when we're triggered. And we want to talk about what that means and how we can do a better job of responding to that. Next week, we're going to explore how we actually resolve conflict and effective tools for going in and trying to bring peace to a difficult situation. I did not grow up wanting to be a divorce lawyer. To be honest, I don't really like conflict. I spent the first 10 years out of law school avoiding conflict. I was in-house counsel. I had a very boring job. I got to read contracts all day. But in about 2006, I had a colleague who really showed me a model of divorce law that resonated with me, and I really felt called into doing divorce work. And so that's all I've been doing since 2006. So why would you want to hear from a divorce lawyer about how to resolve conflict? That's a fair question. After all, lawyers make money off of conflict. We do. The whole model is set up. The more conflict, the more money we make. While I'm an advocate in the divorce process, I am not an advocate for divorce. I care very deeply about our families and about strengthening our families. So much like you would listen to a cardiologist talk about how to avoid heart disease, or you would listen to an oncologist talk about how to avoid cancer, that's what I'm here to do today, is to talk about how can we do a better job of managing conflict and resolving conflict in our families. So hopefully divorce doesn't happen. I love to put myself out of work, but rest assured there's plenty of work, so I'm not really worried about it. I'm going to be here for a long time. Marriages don't fail because of conflict. If you don't have any conflict in your life, you probably are not married. You're also probably not breathing. So marriages fail because of unresolved conflict. I will not be discussing divorce, but I love to talk about it, so you can reach me after if you do want to follow up. If you grew up in a home with conflict, which is super common, many of us did, you know the pain of conflict. Parental conflict, as I mentioned earlier, has a dramatic impact on children, on their sense of identity, their self-esteem, their ability to form healthy relationships and loving relationships. And while I mentioned three cases, high conflict cases, where we had children who were making suicidal threats and were institutionalized, I will tell you that I've had lots of other clients who've come to me after enduring years of high conflict in a marriage, and the children in those cases also, while they were making
making suicidal threats during the divorce that had been a part of their teenagehood. So we know and we can see, even if you're not getting a divorce, just the existence of high conflict in marriage. Staying in a marriage with high conflict can be also devastating. It doesn't protect children the way we would hope that staying married would, but continuing to expose children to conflict can be really devastating. And again, that's why I think it's so important we address this. Conflict changes the trajectory of our children's lives, and I want you to think about that not just in terms of their lives, but it changes it for generations. So when I am talking to my clients about how we're going to handle the divorce, and we're looking at strategies and we're looking at options, I'm always very aware that the decisions we make in this divorce process are not only going to impact my client, the children, but really the children's abilities to go on and carry on healthy, loving relationships. And you see that play itself out. You may know that. That may be familiar to you in your own life. Conflict also causes a lot of stress to us physically in our bodies. Our blood pressure is elevated, cortisol is released, our immune systems are suppressed. You know, there are scientists who are able to tie cancer to stress and, you know, heart issues. So we know that this has a very, very high impact on our overall well-being. So what are we to do with conflict? Well, the Bible tells us that if anyone is in Christ, they are a new creation. The old has gone and the new has come. We have an opportunity as Christians to bring a message of healing and hope into the world. We have obligations in times of conflict, though, and we need to remember those obligations. We are called to recognize the power of conflict to transform lives. Christ himself recognized that conflict is inevitable, and of course we know what happened to Christ and the cross. We are fallen creatures. We are broken. And the remarkable thing about being a Christian is not that we are without conflict, but that as we understand conflict is an opportunity for God to change us. And so that takes a surrender. And I think if you are experiencing conflict in your life, I think one of the most important things you can do is really ask God to come in and be present with you in the conflict. Does it mean the conflict's going to be solved? No. But does it mean you're alone in that conflict? Absolutely not. You do not have to be. Conflict in and of itself isn't a negative thing. I mean, we learn a lot about ourselves in conflict. We clarify our values, what's important to us. I think where it becomes so negative is when we're trying to overpower somebody else in their views and beliefs, or when they're trying to overpower us, right? We get that trying to make somebody see the world the way we see the world, or when you're resisting that from somebody else, right? It wells up within us a sense of, wait, these are different values. These aren't my values. In Life of the Beloved, Henry Nouwen articulates that our lives are taken by God. They are blessed by God. Our lives are broken. And then out of that brokenness, we are able to give, much like the communion Eucharist. It is from our brokenness and in our brokenness that most conflict emerges, whether it's a broken marriage, a lost job, a failed business, suffering pain caused by someone else's negligence, physical, mental, and emotional pain lived under God's blessings is experienced in ways that is radically different from physical, mental, or emotional pain lived without God's blessing. So just, again, God is with you in this. You're not alone. For the Christian, conflict stemming from brokenness creates an opportunity for God to transform our lives. So how do we seize that opportunity? How do we allow God to use conflict to transform our lives and to be a witness in the midst of the conflict? How do we turn away from the temptation to see ourselves as blameless and the other side as the cause of the conflict? I will tell you, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit, one of the key drivers of conflict is blaming. And it is such a natural thing. And we're going to look at what happens physiologically to the brain. But that tendency to blame other people for our discomfort, for our conflict, it fuels the conflict. When we're willing to set aside the blame and really accept personal responsibility and look at this in a different way, then healing happens. I see it often. So we do have tools in our toolbox as Christians. So I think the first thing that is so helpful is perspective, a sense of perspective when we're looking at conflict, right? So, you know, pick your battles. But I find perspective to be really, really healing. So in the moment, it can feel like this is the, like, pivotal issue. But when we can kind of step back and look in the broader scheme of things, we can see a different perspective. So I had a client who was just devastated. His wife had filed for divorce. And this is totally understandable. I get it. But in talking with him, he couldn't get out of just being blindsided and devastated in this. But we're kind of talking through, you know, life things that happen and realizing that when he had a friend who had lost a child. And when you look at what that divorce, the ending of a marriage, and kind of get the different perspective from somebody who is grieving the loss of a child, his whole mental attitude shifted, and he was then able to sort of begin to process. And when I say perspective, I think in the very, very grand scheme of things, as Christians, right? The battle's already been won. It has. The battle's already been fought. So I'm not naive. We have our own little battles that we get to fight in our life. But just keep that perspective. Also, prayer, I think, is so powerful. And we'll talk about that a little bit when we get into the physiology of the brain. And scripture. So I have printed out, these are some scriptures that I think are really helpful, whether you're dealing with fear or sorrow or lots of different issues. So I'll just, we'll just pass those around. Conflict is definitely, it is an everyday part of our day-to-day existence as human beings. So I kind of sat down and wrote through moments in a typical day of my life where I feel that feeling, right? So I get up in the morning and I go walk into the bathroom and my spouse has left his dirty laundry in the bathroom, and in that moment I feel devalued, neglected. I told you how important this is to me and it's not happening. I drive to work and the person in front of me is blocking the right turn lane. They're not turning right. I need to turn right. And now we're stopped at a signal and that's going to cost me 3 minutes, right? I feel irritated and frustrated. I get to work and the project that I'd asked somebody to help me with, they didn't do. And now I'm angry. I'm overwhelmed. I'm going to have to call a client and tell them that the project didn't get done on time. I go to court, and my opposing counsel makes a false allegation against me that I didn't turn over a document or that I misrepresented something. And in that moment, I feel outraged. That is my reputation at stake. I mean, that infuriates me. I come back to the office, and the client who hasn't paid their past due bill still hasn't paid their past due bill, and now I feel really resentful. And I go home, and I find out my teenager has dinged the car again. And all I see are the insurance rates going up, and what are we going to do, and I'm at a loss, and it's frustrating, and really it's scary, because it reminds me that he's driving in a car and could be killed, so really it's a fear that really drives that. I log into Facebook, and I see the fabulous vacation my daughter's friend's family just went on in Europe over the holidays, and I feel envious. I'm stuck here in Dallas going to mediation for 12 hours a day. And I lay down my head at night, and I think of all the things that didn't get done, and now I have internal conflict with myself, right? So that is like just a little glimpse of one day. And there are many, and I know you all have similar experiences of just that feeling, that nagging feeling that, hey, my expectations are not getting met. And it doesn't matter who we are or what we are doing, we all experience other people falling short in our lives. And it arouses that negative emotional response. And I think at its core, conflict is really what happens when we feel devalued and disconnected. It is the disconnection of other people, from our values, from what else is going on, that I think is really driving that. And let me say this. I think one of the reasons why I find family conflict so fascinating is because until we can really figure out family conflict, What hope do we have for world conflict? Because you know what? It's all the same thing. It's just on a different scale. It is. So warring nations, you know, politics, all the everything that's out there, it's just at a bigger scale. But it all, what is happening in our homes is a microcosm of what happens at the bigger scale. So when we feel threatened, what happens? As highly as evolved as we are, we have a primitive operating system that takes over when we feel threatened, right? This is the ancient structure in our brain that was designed to protect us and did a really good job because we're here. Awesome. But this ancient structure, it is designed to make us act quickly and swiftly without thinking, and this is where the problem happens. So when the bear appears, you run. Some of you probably are a runner, but I'm not. If I'm running, it's because a bear's chasing me. So there's something there, and so now I'm going to kind of, a non-scientist is going to go through kind of the brain. So just bear with me. It's very elementary. But I think this is important, and it helps me understand and explain a lot of what happens in that triggered moment. So the amygdala is that yellow almond-shaped mass of nuclei that's located deep in the lobe, and it has to do with a fear circuit in our brain. And this is what causes the fight or flight. So when that amygdala is triggered, we are in our primitive brain. So our brains respond to threats in the same way, regardless of whether it's an actual bear chasing me or it's a bully trying to take my lunch money. It's a threat. And or whether it's somebody who is just maligned my reputation. I'm feeling threatened. It could be a bear chasing me. When someone cuts me off in traffic, physiologically, I'm experiencing the very similar reaction that I would have to other fierce situations. So where our brains were designed to quickly respond to physical threats, to ensure our survival, that's a good thing. Our body is responding to symbolic threats that biologically prepare us to fight, even when there's not an actual physical threat. When somebody maligns my reputation in the courtroom, I don't get to turn around and sucker punch them. I mean, I could, but then I'm going to trigger a response from the bailiff, and that's not going to be good. So if we sense we're about to be abandoned, rejected, lose somebody we love, lose something we love, have our sense of identity threatened, that may trigger that same fear response. And this makes sense when we're aware of what is being threatened. But sometimes we have this overwhelming emotional response and we have no idea why. Because our cortex, the thinking part of our brain, isn't working when the amygdala is triggered. And the other interesting thing about the amygdala is it's also responsible for deciding what memories are stored and the level of emotion that is attached to those memories. So we have memories that are stored in our subconscious, right? These are things that we're not aware of, that we're not thinking about, but yet still can trigger a response because the amygdala knows it and recognizes it. So things that may have happened as a young child or that you've just blocked out or stored away, it's still there, it's still alive in your brain, and it's still participating in how you function. Sometimes we humans have this emotional response that is immediate, overwhelming, and out of measure with the actual stimulus because it's triggered a much more significant emotional threat. So Dr. Daniel Goleman wrote the book called Emotional Intelligence, which is really helpful. I think he does a really good job of explaining this dynamic and discussing why it matters more than an IQ, because this is how we are relating to each other. You have all the head knowledge in the world, but if you don't know and don't understand how you're relating to each other, right, that can be a problem. So when the stimuli enters the brain, right, through your eyes, perceive something that's happening, and it goes to the amygdala gets triggered, I'm sorry, it goes to the thalamus, and the thalamus says, ooh, this is danger, amygdala, go to work, and you trigger a response. Your brain is not functioning. You are now in a heightened emotional state, and problem solving isn't going to happen in this state. Does anybody relate to this? You know what this feels like? When it's triggered and you can't think, right? So lawyers know this. We're actually taught this in law school and trial courses because it's a strategy. You got to like flood your opposing counsel, make their adrenaline cortisol pump out because then they can't think. And it's awesome. It works really well. Huh?
I've taken trial classes because I was never taught that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really fun. You throw out a new witness or some surprise or a new case or something. I mean, you get them off their guard and then you swoop in for the win. What happens is you learn with experience, because it certainly has been done to me, right? I say do it to other people, but it's been done to me, and you learn it through experience how to regulate that and how not to react. You get trained and practiced at that. So when they throw something, a new curveball at you, awesome. That's why I get paid the big bucks. So your amygdala is making a snap decision. You're not thinking through. And now you have adrenaline in your body, you have the cortisol, your heart rate is up, your blood pressure increases, and you're breathing, you're having shortness of breath. You may have a racing heart, shaking, sweating, and nausea. And you're not physically not able to think. And here's the other thing. We have these mirroring neurons in our brain, so when we see somebody else triggered, guess what? It can trigger us. So just being in, like if you've ever been in a fight, an argument, where the other person was triggered first, and now you feel yourself like racing, like why is this stuff coming out of my mouth? I would never say these things if I were thinking, right? It's because now you're triggered. So the reason why this is so important is because awareness of this is where we can begin to change how we respond. I was in a settlement conference. So I do some collaborative law, which is a great process. And we'll talk about some of that next week. But that's where everybody sits in the room together. And usually when we're in divorce context, we don't. We separate the parties because they have an uncanny ability to trigger each other. And then it's just not productive. But we were all sitting in the conference room together, and we are going to talk about dividing up retirement accounts. Okay, this is not a big deal. Y'all are getting a 50-50 division. Pretty much. But the husband was really upset. The wife was leaving him, and he was the one. It was his 401k that was about to get divided. Okay, y'all, he had a huge emotional reaction when we talked about dividing up his 401k. And so when he reacted, I then, because I'm representing the wife, I reacted, right? And now everything's just, the papers literally are like all over the room. Everybody's in a fluster because now everybody's triggered. And, you know, the threats are flying. We'll just see you in court, and it's ridiculous. Okay. You step away from the situation. Take a deep breath. Collect yourself. We can have an actual problem-solving conversation around this. But it was really fascinating to me, because in that moment, I was really curious, like, how did that happen? I know better than to let myself get into this. I mean, these are conversations we have every day. But I was feeling protective of my client, and it totally triggered a response in me. So I needed to ask, how can I show up in a different way and be better at this? So the simple fact of being aware about what is happening can help calm down the brain. It's really interesting. So you can train yourself to recognize what is happening and to regain control of your cortex, that thinking part of your brain. So there are some steps to doing this. First, naming it. So the act of labeling the emotion is incredibly helpful. And you may do this with toddlers. Do any of you all have children? Right? And the toddlers don't quite have the words, but if you help them with the words, oh, I see you're really, you know, frustrated because you can't get your goldfish package open or whatever, you know, you can help give them a context and put words around it. And we are, I mean, we're in our toddler brain, so it helps a lot. I think it's helpful to have a list, because when somebody's triggered, you're susceptible to being triggered, and it's hard to think. But if you can have a list, and now maybe I'll bring that next week, a list of some common emotions that we're feeling when we're angry or frightened or fearful, just the act of naming it alone will help quell the intensity of the reaction. The other thing that really helps is breathing. And I had a therapist who I'm friends with, and he was like, if one more person tells me to just breathe, I'm going to kill them. But he didn't say kill them, but he was going to have a strong reaction. And I get it. It's totally overused. Just breathe. You just need to breathe. But the reality is that the deep inhaling and exhaling is a way that we help eliminate the adrenaline in our body. So when you get that big adrenaline rush, if you can go and, you know, if you want to go for a run, if you have that opportunity, that's great. But even just taking some moments to really to breathe deeply will help quell that strong emotional reaction. Prayer and meditation. So I think this is so key. And again, as Christians, one of the great things that we have a deep understanding, especially as Episcopalians, an understanding of is prayer. And so science does show us that taking time to really meditate and connect, it's the art of mindfulness, connecting our body with what's going on in our surroundings is a great way to calm the stress response down. And I think, you know, we can even go a step further. It's not just mindfulness, but it's connection to God, and inviting God into that moment with you is a great way to connect to God. And, you know, in doing that, you know, if God is on your side, who can be against you, right? I mean, it's suddenly the fear is quelled too. So it's a great strategy. And then taking a time out, and, you know, I know this. Do I exercise it all the time? No. I think having teenagers, they know my triggers better than anybody. And now I have almost three teenagers. And so I feel a lot of triggers from time to time. But taking that time out and just removing yourself from the situation so that you don't say the things that you will regret later is so helpful. The real work comes after a triggering event. So usually if you are the one who's triggered, you know, everything calms down and you kind of move on and you feel fine. Like, okay, now I'm back to life. The people around you may not be. They may still all be going, oh my gosh, I can't believe she just said that, or whatever the situation is. And so I think it's important to really be mindful of what happened and looking at, paying attention to those triggering events. You may not be the best to judge this if your reaction was out of proportion, because, like I said, you're back to normal now and you're ready to move on, but the people around you are not. So I would suggest it's a really good time to ask for some feedback and be open to receiving feedback, because if you don't tend to these things that cause the triggers, they will repeat over and over again and will create patterns that can be really unhealthy. So if you were triggered, for example, because someone didn't load the dishwasher according to your specifications, it might be a time to unpack what's going on with the dishwasher, because it's not the dishwasher that's the problem, right? It really isn't. There's something else underlying that. And until you really give attention to that part of yourself, I think it's really, you're going to continue to see these same triggers. So working with a therapist or a coach or somebody who is trained in this can be incredibly helpful. So when I'm working with divorced people, this is one of the things that we'll talk about, are kind of the triggers for them and whether we need to get some outside help to help them be able to process and move forward. There are basically about five different ways that we tend to respond to conflict. So a big one for me is avoiding conflict. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work. It's not like avoiding the conflict makes the conflict go away. In fact, it can really cause the conflict to fester and show up in uglier ways. So really learning how to approach conflict and deal with it is a much better way, and we're going to address that next week. Giving into conflicts can be a problem too. So the conflict avoiders are oftentimes really good at acquiescing and just kind of like giving in. The problem that I see, especially in the divorce context, is that doesn't solve the problem. That pattern, whatever it is, the conflict is going to continue to emerge. So, for example, if somebody keeps showing up with a kiddo, they're supposed to return them at 6 p.m. and they keep showing up at 7 or 8 p.m., we have a problem. We need to address that. And, you know, when you just ignore the problem, then they start to walk all over you. So that is not a good solution for how to address the problem either. Standing your ground in conflict can feel really noble, and it can be. But it can also just incite conflict, so we need to be careful when we're doing that, especially if we're in how we're standing our ground. Compromising is the idea where, you know, everybody's going to give up a little bit and we're going to both walk away taking less than what we wanted. And, I mean, practically speaking, that's what happens a lot. And okay, that's great. But there are also ways when we can really, if we engage our creative problem-solving brain, we can approach a problem in a way in which everybody walks away as a winner. So not all the time. But I do think that really looking at some creative problem-solving skills, especially when we're using that part of our brain that is designed to solve problems and we're not triggering these reactions, is where our best outcomes are. So we will talk about those different methods in detail next week. And I kind of just like blew through that. Does anybody have any questions? Open it up for discussion. What was that?
When you ask for feedback, you maybe calm yourself down, but the other person's still triggered.
That's a really good question. So you ask for feedback when the other person has calmed down as well. And I usually think, I mean, look, asking for feedback is an act of vulnerability, usually very well received by the other side. Most people don't do it. Right? But it works great in the employment context. It works great in our family with our spouses. It can be hard to hear because it is very vulnerable. But when you are open to receiving feedback and you ask somebody, hey, I really want to hear from you. You know, yesterday didn't go well and I don't like the way I showed up. Right? Those are personal responsibility statements. How did you feel during that interaction? And then be open to hearing from them. And that oftentimes will invite a discussion that can be very, very powerful and very healing. But again, it's hard to do because what you're probably going to hear is some criticism. So you really need to be in a place where you can hear that and you've prepared yourself so that you don't get triggered again, because you can kind of end up in a cycle of, you know, I don't want to go back and talk about the dishwasher incident yesterday because I know it's going to trigger a whole bunch of other things, so we just avoid it, and those resentments over time will crater a relationship. Good question.
I think that's important awareness for us to have, is that in going and asking for feedback. Maybe I should just make I statements instead of we. But I know for me, going to ask for feedback after a conflict of some sort, the receiving of conflict, if you put that slide back up about the brain, the receiving of conflict or feedback is going to put me back into the higher.
It can.
Right? Like, it is a bit of a loop. And so some of the things that we would do to sort of re-engage the higher cortex and disable the amygdala need to be done while you're asking for the feedback, at least while I'm asking for the feedback, or I'm just getting...
So, and I think really one of the biggest things that I have to remind myself is that I don't have to take it personally, right? So I do want feedback from you because I want a relationship with you and I want to know how you're experiencing this right now. And you're going to share with me what your perception is. That doesn't mean that's who I am, right? And that's what is triggered is that sense of identity so often, I think, is that, you know, well, you were really hostile yesterday. You're really impatient. And then I feel like, oh my God, I'm not impatient. I'm the most patient person in the world. What are you talking about? So But when I can say, wow, okay, that person really experienced me being impatient, what does that mean to me? Right? Then it's not a threat. Then I'm not, if I really kind of know who I am, then receiving feedback isn't a threat. But that's a journey. It's a process. And I think that's why it can be really, really helpful to be working with a therapist, especially in the context of marriage, when we're trying to have these discussions. And if you feel yourself continually getting stuck in the triggered place, having a third party who can work with both of you and really help you hear things in a different way so it doesn't feel like a personal attack can be good. But when you've invited feedback, the other thing to do as part of when you ask for feedback is to thank the person who's just giving you feedback. And it's kind of a head game, but it works. And so when somebody sits down and just tells you something that you really wish you didn't have to hear about yourself, just tell them, thank you for sharing that with me. Like it really puts me in a different place, because now, I mean, gratitude and hate don't really go together very well. So even if I'm just saying it and I don't mean it, what I really am feeling right now is like, get out of my face, I don't want to see you. But just having those words come out can really help begin to calm things down. Anybody else? I'm totally open to feedback. So I would love to hear from you all. I would especially love to hear what, maybe if you have questions, specific questions that we can address next week. I can't give you any legal advice, and I can't tell you how to fix your spouse. But if you have some questions, I would love to hear it. And I don't, it's my email. I don't have it out there. I'm easy to find, relatively.
I'll put it up with the recording of the
okay.
So as you think through questions or things that you might want to hear about next week or the week after that from me, drop us a note.
Great. And I want to say thank you for inviting me to be with you all. I really enjoyed your worship this morning. It was so beautiful. How lucky to be here with the kings and the star. So it was a real privilege. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome.